Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. California State Legislature is scheduled to issue a formal apology today, one that is considered long overdue. It comes in the form of a resolution which apologizes for the state's role in the incarceration of more than 100,000 Japanese immigrants and Japanese Americans. In February 1942, weeks after Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt signed an executive order giving the state power to remove Japanese Americans, most of them U.S. citizens, from their homes and place them in internment camps. Actor, activist, and author George Takei lived through internment camps during World War II as a child. Last summer, he released a memoir. It was a nonfiction graphic novel about what life was like for him, his family, and Japanese Americans in the camp. And of course, it affected them afterward. I spoke with him about the book and about his life, about his memoir, and about his time in the internment camp. I began by asking him why he chose to tell a story in a graphic memoir.
Well, in 1994, I wrote my autobiography, and in that, I told the same story of my childhood imprisonment during the Second World War. But still today, when I share my childhood imprisonment story with someone I consider well-informed, well-read person, they're shocked, and I'm shocked that they're shocked, because I've written about it, talked about it often, but there's a lot of America that don't know this chapter of American history. And so I thought, well, I grew up on comic books. I loved comics, and I remember the things that I read in comic books. And so we're targeting the young people, teenagers and young adults, who are going to be the future of America. And I thought I'd share this as I enjoyed comic books and tell the story of my childhood imprisonment to young people who at that age are absorbing in information that stay with them throughout their lives. And so I told it as a graphic memoir, hoping that they, the next generation of Americans, will know this history and play a part in preventing the kind of repetition of history that is happening today on our southern borders.
Why do you think so many young Americans are unaware of this moment in history?
Well, adult Americans are unaware of this. And I've been speaking for the last 25 years at universities, at conferences, and other gatherings on the internment camp story. But our history books, particularly when I was a teenager, I became very curious about my childhood imprisonment because I read our civics books, and I read about the noble ideals of our justice system. All men are created equal. Equal justice under the law. This is a nation ruled by laws. And I couldn't reconcile that with what I knew to be my childhood imprisonment. So I had many discussions after dinner with my father. He was the only one that I could go to with information. Books didn't have any information at all when I was a teenager on the internment. And it was from him that I learned the details of our imprisonment during the Second World War.
I've often had conversations with my friends about what we teach our children in school, and with so much emphasis on math and science and tech, which is important, I think we need to teach history in a better way. How are we ever going to understand each other if we don't?
Particularly some of the more shameful chapters of our history. We get all of the glorious chapters, but I think it's so important for us to know about the chapters where we failed the ideals of our democracy, because that knowledge will help us to make our democracy a truer, just democracy.
My guest is George Takei. He's the author of They Called Us Enemy. You were a very young child, and there's a bit of text that talks about what you remember and what you don't. Would you mind reading a few sentences from that?
Oh, I'd be happy to. It goes like this. My bright, sharp memories are of a joyful time of games, play, and discoveries. Memory is a wily keeper of the past, usually dependable, but at times deceptive. Childhood memories are especially slippery, sweet, and so full of joy, they can often be a misrendering of the truth. For a child, that sweetness, out of context and intensely subjective, remains forever real. I know that I will always be haunted by the larger, vaguely remembered reality of the circumstances surrounding my childhood.
Who did you go to, and where did you find the information about your childhood in the camps?
I was able to go to my father, and, you know, I realize now how unusual my father was. Most Japanese American parents that experienced the internment were so wounded by it, so they had this disgrace, this shame. The shame really belonged to the government, not to them. And yet the victims felt the shame. And so they didn't want to talk about it with their children. And for understandable reasons, they didn't want to inflict their pain and their memory of that pain onto their children. But my father, when I asked him about the internment and how he felt and what the details were, he shared them with me. I read the ideals, the noble ideals of our democracy, and I said, "But Daddy, it was wrong. We had to do something about it. Why did you go into the camps and take us with them?" And he said, "Well, I had to think about your mother, you, your brother, and your sister. They were pointing guns at me. If something happened to me, what do you think would happen with you guys?" And I understood that. But I kept saying, I read in the civics books, this isn't the way it's supposed to be. There has to be due process. We were innocent. We had nothing to do with Pearl Harbor. And yet they imprisoned us. They took everything from us. And so he said, our democracy is a people's democracy. And the people have the capacity to do great things. All the ideals that you read about in your civics books are the product of wise people, the founding fathers and the others that followed. But people are also fallible human beings. We make mistakes. President Roosevelt was a great president in the 30s when the nation was under a crushing depression. People were jobless, hungry, in poverty. And yet, because of the power of his office and his creative problem solving and his political savvy, he was able to create jobs and pull the nation up from under that depression. But when this nation was swept up by war hysteria and racism, he was stampeded. He was a fallible human being as well. And when a great president makes a mistake, it can be a great and catastrophic mistake for the victims of that. And that's why, he said, our democracy is existentially dependent on people who cherish those ideals and actively participate in a participatory democracy. And I kept saying, but Daddy. And so he said, let me show you how it has to work. And one Sunday afternoon, he drove me downtown to the Adlai Stevenson for President campaign headquarters. And there I saw and I experienced what it takes to make our democracy true. I'd heard Governor Stevenson's speeches on the radio. I was inspired by them. He was an eloquent speaker. And there I was, together with other people, passionately dedicated to getting Governor Stevenson elected president. And from that point on, I understood, and I became an active participant in our electoral process, as well as our social justice campaigns.
George, you were incarcerated for almost 4 years at 3 different internment camps. What was daily life like?
Well, there's a parallel story I tell in They Called Us Enemy. I was a 5-year-old kid from Los Angeles, and there we were plunked into the swamps of southeastern Arkansas. It was an exotic place. The name itself, Arkansas, sounded exotic to me. And there were trees that grew out of the water, the bayou. And the tree's roots snaked in and out of the water. It was a fantastical place. There were tiny little black wiggly fish swimming in the creeks. And I could catch them with my hand and put them into a jar and watch them grow. And one day they would start sprouting legs, fish with legs. That's exotic. And the legs grew and got stronger, and then their tails fell off and they hopped out of my jar. So it was a wonderful adventure of discovery for me in the swamps of Arkansas. But that parallel story of the 5-year-old kid me and my parents' story, same experience but dramatically different. They were stripped of everything we had. After Pearl Harbor, their bank account was frozen. With no money, my father couldn't do business, couldn't pay the mortgage, the house was lost. And then the soldiers came and pounded on our front door and ordered us out of our home with bayoneted rifles. And so there are two stories. One, my parents and the larger reality, and the other, a 5-year-old kid's adventure of discovery in the swamps of Arkansas, and later we were transferred to another camp in Northern California, right by the Oregon border, a very cold, windswept, I wouldn't call it sand, it was gritty sand, not the dusty sand of the southern desert. And it was a whole different environment there. And that was a little bit harsher. And I was a little bit older and beginning to feel the sense of imprisonment with the barbed wire fences.
My guest is George Takei. The name of his new book is They Called Us Enemy, a graphic story about the author's experiences in American internment camps during World War II. And I love that you are very specific about language.
Yes.
People you've heard, and I know you have corrected people when they say Japanese internment camps, and your very specific feelings about the phrase concentration camps. Would you share with us your thoughts?
Yes. The phrase Japanese internment camps drive me up the wall because, you know, particularly journalists, they keep repeating that phrase all the time. I frankly suspect that that was a phrase that the government wanted to have used to take the onus, the blame off of themselves. Simple English grammar tells you that Japanese internment camps would be run by the Japanese government. We were American citizens of Japanese ancestry, imprisoned in our own country, here in the United States, in barbed wire prison camps, in our case, Arkansas, and guarded over by the U.S. military and ordered into imprisonment by the President of the United States. The word American has to be there. They were American concentration camps, and to give it a little bit more definition, it should be Japanese American internment camps. Or actually, I think the more precise definition would be concentration camp, because the dictionary definition of concentration camp is the concentrated imprisonment of people of a common heritage, race, culture, or faith in a barbed wire prison camp for political purposes. Now, when I use the word concentration camp in some of my college speeches, Jewish people stand up and say and share the stories of the horrific family experience, losing members of their family to the Holocaust. They were not for political purposes. The intent of those Nazi camps was to annihilate a whole people. It was a systematic, programmed, intentional annihilation of a people.
A genocide.
They were concentrated to be killed. They're death camps. They were extermination camps. We were in concentration camps for a political purpose.
How did news make it to people in the camps? Did it make it to people in the camps?
No. Radio was forbidden, mail was forbidden or censored. We got no information from the outside world. In the Tule Lake camp in Northern California, there was a whispered rumor. Somehow the information got into the camp about a horrific bomb that was dropped on the city of Hiroshima. A horrific new bomb that wiped out the entire city. But there was no specific information about it. It was only whispered. It was rumored. And there were guards that kept us from getting information. So information from the outside was verboten.
This, as I hear you describe it, it just sounds and feels so terrifying.
It was.
Yeah.
I mean, for my parents,
mm-hmm.
for me, every day was an adventure. But for my parents, and I, this is what I heard from my father when we had those many after dinner conversations. He said the worst part of the imprisonment wasn't the sentries with their guns pointed at us, or the searchlight that followed us when we made the night runs to the latrine. The worst part was the uncertainty. We didn't know what might happen in the next 5 minutes, or in the next hour, or tomorrow. Every day there was some new horror. For my parents, it was a harrowing experience, and the whole terror came from not knowing what's going to happen next. My father said he'd look at us, the three of us. I was 5 years old when we were incarcerated. My brother was four, and my baby sister was an infant. And it tore him apart to think what our future might be like. What is going to happen to his children when we're being held prisoner, when we're innocent behind these barbed wire prison camps with guns pointed at us, searchlights following us, regimentation, order. What's going to happen to us? They had so much hope for us, and now you couldn't hope for, well, you hope for the next day being safe.
What impact, when you think about it and you look back on your life and on your parents' life, how do you think that period of time affected them and the choices they made for themselves and for their family?
There was a relentless series of goading outrages against them. First, you know, we were impoverished, and then we were imprisoned. But to go back a little bit, Immediately after Pearl Harbor, young Japanese Americans, like most Americans, rushed to their recruitment centers to volunteer to serve in the U.S. military. This act of patriotism was answered with a slap in the face. They were denied military service and categorized as enemy alien, which was totally irrational. They were patriots volunteering to fight for this country, and they were natural-born Americans. And so to call them enemy and alien was crazy. But that's what held, and we were imprisoned. A year into imprisonment, the government realized there's a wartime manpower shortage, and here are all these young men that they could have had, but they were classified as enemy alien. How to justify drafting people out of a barbed wire prison camp to fight for the country that's imprisoning them? Their solution to that dilemma was as irrational and even more unthinking as the imprisonment itself. It was a series of questions called the loyalty questionnaire. But there were two questions that became heatedly controversial, and all 10 camps were in confusion and outrage. Question 27 simply asked, "Will you bear arms to defend the United States of America?" This being asked of my mother, who had 3 children, one now a toddler, my baby sister. I was 6 by then. My brother was 5. She was being asked to abandon us, to bear arms, to defend the nation that's imprisoning her family. It was preposterous. Question 28, the following question, was one sentence with 2 conflicting ideas, which I'll paraphrase. It asked, "Will you swear your loyalty to the United States of America and forswear your loyalty to the Emperor of Japan?" Forswear our loyalty to the Emperor of Japan? We're Americans. My mother was born in Sacramento, California. My father was born in Japan, but he was brought to the United States when he was a boy, to San Francisco. He was raised and educated in San Francisco. And for the government to presume that we have an inborn racial loyalty to the emperor was insulting. We never even had thought of the emperor, much less swear a loyalty to him. So if he answered no, meaning I don't have a loyalty to the emperor to forswear, that no applied to the first part of the very same sentence. Will you swear your loyalty to the United States? If you answered yes, meaning I do swear my loyalty to the United States, then that yes applied to the second part of the sentence meant that you were confessing that you had a loyalty to the emperor and were now prepared to forswear it and repledge your loyalty, our loyalty to the United States. It was an outrageous, insulting, and ignorant question. My parents answered no to both questions, and therefore they were categorized as disloyal, and we had to be transferred from the Arkansas camp called Roar to the Northern California camp by the Oregon border, which was called the segregation camp for disloyals. And so we were in the third camp for disloyals. And this was another overreaction by the government. It was not just one barbed wire fence, but 2 more layers, 3 layers of barbed wire fences, and a 6 tanks patrolling the perimeter to intimidate people that were goaded into outrage by the stupidity of that loyalty questionnaire.
Hearing your stories and your family's story, and then when we think about the news that we see coming from the border and the migrant crisis and the way this administration is handling it and this situation, what is something you want people to know? Something that you know in your gut or your heart from your experience that you think people really need to understand about this situation on the southern border.
Again, it's what my father told us, that we have to be actively engaged. Our democracy is existentially dependent on people who cherish the ideals of our democracy and participate in it. And what's going on today on the southern border is a new, incredible, repulsive low. I mean, at least when we were incarcerated, we children were not torn away from our parents. We were together as a family. What's happening today now is children and sometimes infants are being torn away from them and put in cages in the human filth. And really, to underscore the evil in all this, some children and infants are scattered to the farther reaches of the United States from where they were torn away from their parents, to Minnesota, Wisconsin, New Jersey. And when the courts order them to bring the children back to their parents, they are so incompetent that they've lost track of them. They can't bring the children and the parents together again, or the parents may have been deported already. I mean, it is a new level, low of horror that we are engaging in with this corrupt administration.
We all know books go to press long time before they ever hit the bookshelves, yet there's a panel in the book which is prescient. A car is being vandalized with the words, it's a Japanese American's car, and it says, "Get out." And obviously, we've seen that in the news recently when the current president has tweeted about four congresswomen should go back to the countries that they came from, even though three of them were born here and they're all American citizens. Why do you think this particular kind of racism is pervasive? That it could be something that would be in a book that is about years and years ago, and it's in a book that you wrote before this happened, yet this is a drumbeat that still is pounded.
We keep repeating our history because we don't know our history. Send them back is an echo of what we heard. Or in 2016, during the presidential campaign, we heard, "Lock her up." Well, the chant in California in the 1940s, early 40s, was, "Lock up the Japs." And we had an attorney general in California at that time, the top attorney, the man that's supposed to know the Constitution and know the law. He became historically remarkable. His name was Earl Warren. Later on became the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. But at that time, he was the attorney general. He was ambitious. He wanted to be elected governor. And he saw that the "Lock up the Japs" chant was very loud. It was a very strong and popular chant at that time. And so in order to get his name out in front of the other candidates for the governorship, he made, as attorney general, this amazing statement. He said, "We have no reports of spying or sabotage or fifth column activities by Japanese Americans, and that is ominous because the Japanese are inscrutable," that stereotyping word. "And so therefore, because we can't figure out what they're thinking, it would be prudent for us to lock them up before they do anything." So for this attorney general, the absence of evidence was the evidence. And he became very popular, got elected governor, got reelected not just once but twice, served three terms, and then was appointed to be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. And he goes down in history as the, quote, liberal close quote, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. The Brown versus the Board of Education ruling on segregated, separate but equal education ruling.
My guest has been actor, activist, and author George Takei. The name of the book.
And actor, too.
The book is called They Called Us Enemy, and you don't need to be a Star Trek fan to follow him on Twitter. What's your handle, George? It's pretty good. Your Twitter feed.
At George Takei. I call this book, They Called Us Enemy, my book of hope for the future of America. Because when young people grow up knowing this story, as important a story of America as the heritage of slavery that we have, or the story of the annihilation of the Native Americans when the westward expansion began. When the people grow up with this and they are in the majority, then people like the current occupant of the White House, that housing that we're paying for, the president is staying in public housing, then that kind of man will not be elected president of the United States.
George Takei.
It's our hope.
It was a pleasure speaking with you, George.
I'm not bringing good news, but it's an important news. And thank you very much for letting me talk about my hope for the future.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.